Welcome to the Jimmy Office Hours podcast, where academics talk about academics. We'll travel from the depths of liberal arts to the forefront of practical application. Join us as we dive into critical discussions shaping the minds of tomorrow.
Welcome to Jimmy Office Hours. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my colleague, Jacob Barnard. And Jacob, we've got a great program in store for our listeners today. I'll let you introduce our guest.
Absolutely. And the idea for this episode actually came from a conversation we had at the end of the year faculty get together. We were chatting, but we have Jim Baer. Jim, if you could introduce yourself real quick.
Yeah, so I'm Jim Baer. I'm part of the teacher education faculty at University of Jamestown, and I guess I'm just happy to be here and see what you guys have to teach me.
All right. Well, it might be the other way around today, Jim, but we'll see what we can teach each other and hopefully impart to everybody else who's listening to us. But so the basis of today's topic is improv is a life skill. And we're talking about courses, and so just to kind of summarize the conversation, you'd mentioned something, and I think this might be a good spot to start, about your, I believe it was your principal certification, because you used to also be, and something where it was basically the test I concluded was, well, they're making you do improv, and you have to prove that you can do improv? Huh, that's it. So could you tell us a little bit about what that was?
Yeah, so certainly. So I graduated with my master's in ed leadership from NDSU, and most of that program was an online program. I mean, at that time, online meant different than it does now. We did meet via Ivan and different things. But for one of the final sessions that we had, and it was actually a test at the end to determine whether or not we would make a good principal, they invited existing principals and teachers and different community members in and basically role played, right? And so that was that, and I didn't realize till after the fact this was almost sort of an interview as well. so then you were able, they were people who were talent scouts, if you will, looking for people to fill that role. But what was super fun about that, and I have brought this into what I do in the classroom now, is it really made me think. I mean, that was some of the most valuable experience I had through the whole program, because it actually puts you in that space where you were pretending to be that person and fill that role.
So Jim, one thing that I remember about improv, right, is that when you're in that space where you're doing improvisation, you're always supposed to respond yes and so no cuts everything off, right? But when you say yes and, it keeps the conversation going. And I can't think of a better analogy for what we do in education, right? Because it's always about moving the conversation forward, moving knowledge forward. Can you start talking a little bit about maybe what that looks like in an educational setting?
Sure. So for me, it's interesting to think about how we actually learn these skills. And unlike you, Scott, I've had very little actual communication experience, right? Or education. But when we think about how this looks like from my perspective in education is a lot of silence. Like you just referenced, yes, and. Well, that's key for me in my classroom situations too. I don't want our future teachers to be people who think they want to stand in front of that classroom and just talk. So I like that, yes, and, because that's, or maybe a yes, but, or maybe a yes, what if, right? because a lot of that, and I think we didn't really define improv here yet. And maybe that's a good place to go. So maybe you guys could do that for me.
Yeah. Well, we probably all have a little bit different definitions. Scott, so far, I believe, has alluded to the correct definition or the correct interpretation. The reason I decided that this would be a really good topic, though, is in my area, you know, computer science, computing, I've never thought of it as improvisation. I've always thought of it as following a process, which maybe this is jumping ahead in the conversation, but I don't know if those are mutually exclusive. So yeah, you're absolutely correct, Jim. We should define improv, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have one definition to rule them all, because I think we're all interpreting it a little bit differently, which is absolutely just fine. So, Scott, do you want to?
So in my context, in communication studies, which is closely aligned a lot of times in higher ed with the theatrical arts, there's this idea where actors learn the art of acting by putting them in a situation. And if you've ever been to an improv show, you've seen this, right? Where they'll solicit ideas from the audience and they'll give them a particular situation, a couple, for instance, a couple having a dinner at a high-end restaurant. And so then they start acting out this scene and they play off one another. And so the first rule of learning how to improvise in an acting situation is that if you're with your acting partner, whatever your acting partner says, you answer with yes and, even if you do it quietly in your mind, because that keeps the scene going. And obviously you have to be quick and you have to think on the fly. And so as this applies to what we're talking about today in communication, all of us have been in that situation where we're in front of the classroom and we have our lesson plan. But as we know, things do not go as planned. Rarely ever do they go as planned. And so learning how to roll with the punches, so to speak, in a classroom is very, very helpful. And I think it's helpful for our students to develop that skill, because if they come into the classroom and they are content with being handed this particular construct and they have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's, that's going to lock them into a process that you alluded to, Jacob, where there's not a lot of room for creativity. There's not a lot of room for growth. So when I think about education as improv, I'm thinking about walking into a situation, attempting to evaluate where our students are with strategic questions, and then allowing them to contribute to that particular method where we slowly move them along in the direction of the way that we want them to go. And of course, for every discipline, this is going to look different.
And I think it's really interesting because at least in my discipline, I've never considered it improv. But that's really what we've been trying to convey. Your comment on walking into the we've all had things go wrong in the classroom that did remind me of the you know, just a little anecdotal story. My very first teacher observation was first year teaching here. Had somebody from FacDev come over and observe the classroom, and that was the one day this semester that everything in the computer lab broke. About 5-10 minutes into the class, but I think it was actually the highest compliments and things I had gotten returned back to me. Like, wow, nothing worked, but you filled the whole class period by switching and doing X, Y, and Z. And I thought, well, yeah, if you try one thing, it doesn't work. You try the next thing. That defined process that we really focus on in competing in computer science, it's because you never know what you will get with computers or any career, really. And so, Jim, it'd be really interesting to hear, how do you convey that in the education classes? Because we're trying to convey something similar in all of our classes, really. But I don't think we're putting in the terms of improv. And maybe that's hiding, or maybe that's a better way to put it than here's your 10-step process to follow when something breaks. How are you guys covering that in the ed classes?
Yeah. No, that's super interesting, you know, and I agree with you. I haven't really thought about that in terms of improv either. I mean, in a lot of ways, that's just life, right? You know, we go through our day to day and we do the things that we do. But since we're in charge of whether it's us as faculty members at UJ or whether it's the students that we're going to be teaching that are going to be in charge of their own classrooms, ultimately their job, their life is leading these kids on a path. And it's really interesting when you think about, when you talk about the computer lab and having things break there. I mean, as you probably know, I teach the tech class for our ed students as well. And that's one of the things I talk about because how easy is it if you're relying on technology to do whatever it is you're trying to do in a classroom, which all of our teachers are doing right now. And then when it breaks, to just throw your hands up and say, I'm done. Right. but you can't, right? And but it's no different than if it's technology or if it's that Bobby came into the classroom and decided he was going to throw a fit, right? It's really the same thing. If whether it's a computer or whether it's Bobby that's messing things up, you still have to be in that situation where you're going to have to deal with that. So, you know, I think it was alluded to, well, practice is all any of this takes, right? And this really, in my mind, that's the thing that, and I know myself and all the rest of the ed faculty do this same thing, where we put kids in front of that class as much as we possibly can. And part of it is we try to, it's not always easy when kids have classes outside of the education realm, but we try to get them out into the field and take them out of UJ and put them in front of actual students and really just work through that practicing part of that. Now, I think I think a process like Jacob referred to, or and even actually what Scott, what you were referring to as well, when we start asking those questions with the yes and, we, as far as I know, and maybe I'm alone, but we don't really have any of those explicit things that we refer to when we're talking to our ed students. It's really just getting them in front and having them do it, and that's as much as I think we can do.
Jim, when it comes to education, what are some of the basics that you start with now as opposed to when you first started in your career, whenever that was? How has education evolved and changed in the last few years when you're working with teachers that are going to be in the classroom at all levels of education?
Well, any ed faculty, when you ask the three most important things, any ed faculty at UJ, when you ask the three most important things about education, they're going to say it's relationships, relationships, and relationships, right? And that's one of those things that has changed fairly drastically. And I think, I mean, COVID changed a lot of things, but that was a catalyst for certainly this in education, because we started hearing a lot more about social emotional issues that our students were having. And because of that, again, this improv we're talking about has become more important as well. But it's super interesting to me too, because I started teaching at University of Jamestown in the fall of 2020. So I haven't known teaching in higher ed. I did some adjuncting before that, but for the most part, I haven't known higher ed outside of the realm of post-COVID. But what really struck me I remember the first class I taught at UJ, the first day I taught, I was teaching my assessment and evaluation course, and I had a presentation prepared, and I had my PowerPoint up, and I was talking to students, and everything I said, they were writing down furiously, right? and that just boggled my mind, because I was a principal prior to that, and that wasn't my experience in education. And I don't want that to be the experience, frankly, because I want the educational experience when we're in that classroom, and that this is a trend that we've seen more of in recent years, is just this idea that everything that happens in that classroom should be a back and forth. It should be a discussion, because you don't learn, and this is one of the things that I tell my students, you don't learn by listening to somebody speak. You learn by speaking yourself, right? You have to take part in that process. And for me, that improv piece we're talking about, that makes that so much easier too, because we want our kids interacting and going back and forth. And so to me, that's what I started teaching in 1998. And, you know, one of the things that the older teachers said when I started teaching was how, you know, kids are just different than they were, right? Kids don't want to study anymore. Kids don't want to learn. Kids don't want to take responsibility. Well,
I find myself saying that a lot these days.
Yeah, and that hasn't changed though. For the last 26 years, people have been saying that. And so apparently those kids who didn't pay attention and didn't care in 1998 are now the good students. I don't know how that works, because it should be pretty drastically bad if that were actually the case. But to me, those, again, that back and forth, those relationships just has become more and more important. But if you look back in the history of education, I mean, this has been ever since the 1920s when John Dewey started being taken seriously and we started to talk about student-centered education, we've we've gone back and forth, right? We've gone back and forth between these ideas of having rich, of strict, rigid classrooms, or having more of this back and forth. And frankly, when you look at the data indicating which methods of things work better, there isn't any real clear data to indicate, right? We don't see test scores, no matter what policies we put in place, we don't really see test scores going up or down regardless. So it does make a person struggle a little bit in terms of what that really should look like. But oftentimes it does just have to be dependent on those formative assessments that happen in that classroom, like you were talking about just recently here too. So
no, it's interesting that you mentioned the relationship part of it, because when we're teaching a process, whether that's a process or improvisational skills like you were talking about in class, it's really about finding a level of comfort with the unknown. The example I've used is in like an IT help desk class. IT help desk, you never know what's going to come up. Your instant response can't be, "You did what?" Even though it may want to. Just like when a student walks up to you and hands you in work, you did what? Is not the appropriate learning mechanism there. And so how we handle those, the soft skills, as Scott and I've talked about before, really kind of factor into that. And then once they get out of here, whether they're teaching or in an IT one, the relationships are what really bring things together. It reminds me, when I was working on my PhD in IT, one of my colleagues was spending their research on generational differences in the workplace. This was post-COVID, or shortly after COVID spring, I think is what we refer to it as now, but found that the expectation is usually that the younger the individual, the more they want remote work, the more they do not want to be tied to an office and those sort of things. And that's not what she found. What she found is that particularly the younger generation who are either in college or coming out of college want to be in the workplace, because that's the old water cooler chats. They'd be able to interact with individuals, particularly those who may have been there longer, gain that institutional knowledge, whether that is a school or, you know, the IT help desk. It would be really, really rough going straight from remote classes to remote work. Yes, you can. It is digital communication is of course possible. Computer mediated communication is one of my favorite comm topics. So it's possible, but figuring out those relationships and learning from others that what the responses should be to random scenarios, we learn that from others. And that kind of seems to be what you're saying, Jim, is that that's how you're teaching the ed students, by getting them into a classroom as soon as possible so they can have the experience, but the resources around them for how to handle that experience. When Billy or whoever the student you mentioned was has their meltdown in class, Billy probably did too. You know, how do you deal with that scenario? Similar kind of, you know, it's improv. Is it a process? Is there really a difference? I don't know. But you're doing the same sort of thing in IT, and I'm wondering if maybe in my classes I should be putting it in those terms. Hey, this is improv. Maybe that catches the attention as opposed to a step-to-step process, even if it's the actuality is the same thing.
You know, you talk about IT especially, and as you know, I spent some time in IT at UJ as well, and more about that job is relationships than computer skills, right? I mean, we really are saying that very same thing. And I know when I came in, I had come out of, I was principal before I was that as well for a couple of years. And I wasn't the top tech guy in Sorkness over there, right? But I was still the person that a lot of people came to, I think, because I had practice as a principal when I had to work with parents or students or whoever else, because those soft skills were important. So yeah, no, I agree with you. I think in your tech field, those soft skills are certainly something that should be tried to achieve.
Yeah. And that tends to be the thing employers come back with too, of, you know, technical skills, a new programming language, whatever. If we covered the basics, it's applying those in unknown or new scenarios. That's what employers are looking for, and the ability to communicate those, work well with others. Even if you're a solo programmer who your goal is to never see the light of day, that's absolutely fine, but you still have to engage with other people somehow, in some way or fashion. So those are the ones employers tend to come back with saying, no, this is what's missing in the workforce.
So I have a friend who says all the time that, and I think it's a great rule to sort of govern our lives by, is that life moves at the speed of relationships. So everything happens, right? So the old axiom, it's not necessarily what you know. Certainly that's important, but it's also who you know. And learning to develop those relationships and learning how to engage with people that we may not have much in common with, but finding that common ground, establishing that rapport, and then moving forward. I remember when I was in graduate school and I was trying to figure out which direction I was going to go in my graduate studies, and I ended up taking 30 hours beyond my master's degree in an education program and earned a specialty in community college education. And I remember one of those classes specifically, the professor wanted us to come up with an analogy for being a teacher in the classroom. And so some people talked about, you know, being a guide and being a prophet, you know, and I think all of that works. But the analogy that I came up with, and I think it works perfectly with what both of you are talking about right now, is that the best analogy I can come up with for a teacher in the 21st century is a late night talk show host. And so if you think about those great talk shows of the past, whether it's Johnny Carson or David Letterman, or even now with Jimmy Fallon and Stephen Colbert, those shows have a particular format. So you have the host come out and he delivers a monologue. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's commentary on what's happening in the world, but he opens it up with a monologue and then he introduces guests and they come and they either promote their movie or they share their expertise and there is a conversation. So I think as educators and teachers, keeping in mind the truth of that life moves at the speed of relationships, we should limit those monologues. And if you watch late night television, you probably notice that the monologues over the years have gotten shorter and shorter and shorter. Probably has a lot to do with people's attention spans, but also the format continues to update and change and evolve. So now the monologue at the beginning of the show is relatively short compared to what it was in Johnny Carson's day and age. And then the guests come in. And now, especially with shows like Stephen Colbert, it doesn't necessarily have to be comedic. It doesn't necessarily have to be entertainment-based. There's a lot of substance that is discussed as well. And so what if we started treating our classrooms and developing the next generation of teachers to see themselves as people that are facilitating these relationships? So yes, open up your classroom and your lesson with a monologue, but then move quickly into those dialogues where you're speaking to one another and you're moving it forward. And also keeping in mind, fortunately or unfortunately, that so much of what we do in our world today is entertainment based. And I know that we're not all going to be Hollywood comedians or personalities, but we need to think in terms of, hey, whenever, and this is true certainly in the communications discipline, whenever you're standing in front of an audience, you're in show business. So you've got to keep it moving, you've got to facilitate it, and you've got to keep it interesting. One of the things I share with my students all the time is that if your audience goes to sleep on you, it's not their fault, it's yours. So as educators, we have a responsibility to keep our audience, in this case, our students, engaged and awake. And that requires us being creative. So I know I sort of said a lot there, but I'll let you guys follow up on that analogy of an educator being a late night talk show host.
Could we go a step further and ask the question, how does that change in our world of TikTok?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, think on that, because we've got, it always boggles my mind when I see people looking at their TikTok screens for hours and it's nothing, right?
Right.
We've got people who are recording short videos of them with, in my mind, with no content at all. And so you talk about starting with a monologue, but those monologues get shorter and shorter. And I wonder, is TikTok just that next step where it's not really funny? It's not really anything. It's just short little blips.
Absolutely. I mean, you think of there's the comparison for how we, to steal some ideas from journalism, the newspaper, but then we have the USA Today, which is the small bite size web development. When we're talking about writing content for the web, it's got to be short, their attention span, if you don't capture their attention in 3 seconds, they're gone. Is that conveying over to the classroom, and which means those improvs picking things up on a dime? Yes, you may have a response pattern, a process, if you will, are even more important because we've got that much less time to capture the attention. As Scott was saying, really the what is the entertainment factor, and whether it's you're the ringleader or the conductor, that engagement part's even more important.
Yeah. And just to follow up on that, there's two ways to look at this, right? So the famous book, Neil Postman, Musing Ourselves to Death, which, in that he said, he was lamenting the fact that, it was written in the 1980s and it was very prophetic in that he was lamenting the end of a written culture of people actually reading and absorbing information that way, and as quickly moving to an entertainment-based society where everything, Jim, like you mentioned, is those TikTok videos where there are some of substance, but for the vast majority of them, it's just doom scrolling, right? Where you're seeing absolutely nothing, and for hours and hours and hours, it's consuming your mind with nothing of substance. And so he was lamenting the fact that was the direction that the world was going. And certainly I think there's part of me, there's part of all of us that came up at a certain time in the world, and we look at it from a certain perspective that we see the world differently. But the flip side of that is the world has changed. And so, the cow is out of the barn. So what are we going to do on this side of the reality that our students are dealing with a very short attention span, and the students, the generation coming up behind them, are even shorter. They've been raised on media via small screens and small, very short bites. And what are we going to do about that? So I think this might be a good time for us to take our mid-hour break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about some of the realities in that entertainment culture in which we now all find ourselves as educators. You're listening to Jimmy Office Hours, and we'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Jimmy Office Hours. I'm Scott Lloyd, along with my colleague, Jacob Barnard. And today we are privileged to have Jim Baer with us. And he is part of the education faculty here at the University of Jamestown. And Jim, before the break, we were talking about, in fact, you're the one that brought this up, this idea of the TikTok generation and everything being short and everything being very concise and quick and moving on. I remember a few years ago, the standard for broadcast television was that if you were editing something, the image had to change every 5 seconds. It's been a while since I've checked that, but I suspect that that's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So as educators teaching the next generation of educators, how do you deal with some of those realities, and what are some of the tools that you're implementing into the classroom to connect with students who are, sort of expecting the world to continue to be as they see it and as they consume it through media?
Well, I guess in my mind, I always like to see how we can leverage that. So it's a challenge, certainly, because we always need to some teachers feel like they always need to be the entertainer in front of the room, right? And I guess if you've ever been in my classroom, I'm not the entertainer in front of the room. But with that said, one thing that I recognize, and this goes along with the TikTok generation as well, is when you look at the content that's out there, there's not a lot of substance, as you had mentioned, Scott, but it's also true that it is people who are revealing things about themselves, right? And so one of the things we can leverage is we can let kids talk about themselves. That's because not only do they want to do that, if you can get them to talk about themselves and relay experiences of their own that's related to the content which you're delivering, which is perhaps easier in education and communication than it would be in computer science. But if a guy can do that, now what we have is we have them on the stage, and that's what they want. Ultimately, I'd be lying if I said I really understand the draw of the TikTok, but
it's all right. We're all struggling here. I promise you.
but I do think that there is that element of kids are relating to what they see. And not only are they relating to what they see, they're going to go and they're going to do it themselves. And for whatever reason, this whole thing feeds itself, and it's created something that's getting more attention than practically any other media we see. And so what I like to do, and this is what I tell my students as well, is you give the kids the stage as much as you possibly can. They are more interested in each other than they are in me anyway. And then that also helps develop a community of relationships within that classroom. And so that is closely related to that whole TikTok mentality, I believe, but it also is what we think of as good teaching. So,
yeah, that brings up, two thoughts. Is the first one is you pointed this out much earlier, but this is nothing new. We've been saying, hey, they don't pay attention, they don't learn. That's been getting said for a zillion years. You know, we Roman graffiti on the walls of Pompeii. You know, some things just are always going to be that the younger generation doesn't XYZ whatever, inserted in now. And you know what the buzzword the last couple of years has been: critical thinking skills with AI. You know, they don't need to think anymore. Well, yet they also said that about the invention of the computer. Oh, people won't need to know stuff. So how we handle it, just to reassure ourselves, is this is a natural cycle. So we know this is going to happen. We know that we're going to have to adjust things. We do a lot of our teaching based on what was taught to us and how we learned to convey knowledge. Also knowing that not all of those methods worked for ourselves. And so figuring that out, and you know, with the AI, we've been, at least in CS and IT, we've been really, really talking about needing to move to a show not tell model. Because, well, yeah, AI can write code, but I want you to show that it works. So things like more student presentations, one of the favorite ones I saw one of my faculty do this year was, I think a couple of them did it. They had students create a tutorial for one of the lessons, and that was their assignment, was to create a tutorial for their classmates. And as educators, you guys know there's no better way to learn something than try to teach somebody else. I was talking with a prospective grad student the other day, and that was, they're asking me about, well, I don't know if I want to teach. And I'm like, well, if you really enjoy learning stuff, you will enjoy teaching. Because the best way to learn is to teach. And so I'm wondering if we just need to integrate. We've tried, and in some cases we do too far in some of the classes with some of the flipped classroom stuff that can get a bit much. But like you're saying, Jim, putting them on that stage, giving the opportunity to show, it embraces the new technology, which we're going to have to do at some point anyways, whether we want to or not. But B, gives them that opportunity to get themselves out there a little bit. And that's where the biggest hesitation I tend to see with students, I don't know if it's particularly the computing classes or what, but it's that discomfort of, I want to show everybody, but I don't. I want to be, you know, shy or whatever it is. And so finding more ways of doing that more regularly forces the improv skills.
And they want to. right? I mean, even if they say they don't want to, they do want to. Once you get them doing it, it snowballs fairly quickly. And that's something, I mean, I know it seems like a lot of students, depending on the size of the school or where they've gone to school, when they come in, when I have them in intro to ed, this is their first time speaking in front of a crowd sometimes. And this just boggles my mind. They never had a high school class where their teacher put them in front of the class and had them speaking. But a lot of them say that. So I'm hesitant to think that they're not remembering things accurately. I do think that that's probably true. But once they start doing it, and again, those relationships are key, right? As long as they have good relationships with their peers in that classroom, which for the most part, they do and they can once they have made that leap. It's all about making that comfort zone bigger. The only way to make that comfort zone bigger is to get them to step outside of that comfort zone, and then it just naturally grows, right?
Now that you mention that, usually when I've heard complaints or just concern in the past about things like presentations, it hasn't necessarily been about the being up in front itself. It's been about the group work, the dreaded group project. I have to rely on others. If I just show myself in front of others, you know, I have had the one or two extremely shy or inner individuals who were just absolutely terrified of going up in front of a group. That's understandable. And there's ways to work on that. And I can do that to you too. But if now I'm thinking about it, now that you mentioned it that way, it's usually the group aspect that seems to be, I don't want to do that, more than you're making me get up in front of everybody.
But group work is a struggle for a lot of reasons, right?
Right.
I mean, and I think, and I do believe that our technology has made that potentially worse, because students, if you assign group work, it's rare that they're actually going to get together and do it, because they can just send an email. And now if you've got a group of 3, 4, 5 students, there's going to be one who takes the lead, and that student oftentimes is the one that does a big chunk of the work. And so that student doesn't like it because they're doing a big chunk of the work, but also the student who isn't doing the work doesn't like it because they don't feel like they're a part of things. And maybe, you know, there's so many different dynamics in that group. And that's again, one of those things that, I mean, I do try to focus on group work in my courses simply because I want them to recognize what happens when you do that. But also there has to be a little bit of coaching throughout that group work as well, because everybody needs to be able to step up, and everybody needs to be able to figure out how they're going to contribute equally or in a meaningful way in a group. But oftentimes just group work goes sour pretty quickly sometimes.
Oh, and it does. And that's nothing new, but it's interesting that you put it in terms of, you know, it's even more difficult these ways, because I'd been thinking of it the opposite, just experiences in my undergrad of, I remember dropping a class entirely because I got mad at the group. They'd schedule things like 3 hours before. I think it was my second senior year of my undergrad. That, nope, I'm working tonight, I can't do that. Went to the professor's time. You know, was, oh, you'll have to figure that out. And I'm, no, I don't. Don't need this class to graduate. I'm out. Which 20 whatever years later, that probably wasn't the best way of dealing with it. But in my head, it's been, oh, group work's so much easier now. Let's hop on a Zoom. But you're absolutely right. Those tendencies, we know every group is like that, or the fear that every group is going to be like that is something. So maybe that's something we can, you know, better address or provide those tools. Like you're saying, Jim, that's one of the learning outcomes of our program too, is, you know, being able to work in a group. But are we introducing that early enough or staged enough with enough support structures? Great. Here is a meeting template that you guys need to fill out every time you meet. Whatever the technique is, I don't know, because I think that's it. It's the fear of having to force relationships with not enough experience in how to do that back and forth. Jim Scott and I ended up on a committee this year. We'd all have the experience to say, hey, Jake, we haven't heard from you in 3 weeks. Here's what we need to do. But students do not. And so they hate group work. And maybe it's the dealing with the relationships more than having to be up and do public speaking. And because everybody says they're scared of the public speaking and those parts of it, but that's not what they complain about on the feedback. But when they said, oh, I had to do this horrible group project or wonderful group project, it's not the presentation part that they actually complain about.
And I think this is where a robust liberal arts education is very helpful, right? Because, Jim, you referenced the students' fears about being in front of a group or the group work that is involved. And this is something that we address in one of the core components of a liberal arts education, which is rhetoric, right? Public speaking. And part of what we do in my discipline of communication is that we emphasize group work. In fact, one of the assignments that I give every semester in public speaking is a group project. And I tell the students, this is as much about the process of learning to get along with one another, to solve problems like logistics, making sure that you're all on the same page, dealing with schedules that are difficult to nail down, that are constantly changing, and delivering a quality presentation on the other end. Does that mean practically and realistically that some of you are going to have to take responsibility, more responsibility than other members of your group? Absolutely. But welcome to the real world, right? That's how life works. We cannot expect everybody in the group to be as competent as maybe you are or as skilled as you are at a specific skill set. And what it takes within in the group work is learning how to manage all of those different personalities, all those different talents, and to bring them together in a way that produces a quality product in the end. So it develops skills like leadership. So everyone knows, I think, that Jacob and I really like Star Trek, right? So to use a Star Trek analogy, what was Jim Kirk's skill set, the captain of the Enterprise? What did he do? Well, you had McCoy that was a doctor. You had Spock that was a science officer. You had Scotty who was responsible for engineering and keeping the ship together. What Uhura was the communications officer. What did Kirk do? Well, he didn't do anything. He was the leader, and leadership is a skill set. And it's an important responsibility to manage all of those personalities and to bring them together to solve the problem. And so this is where the liberal arts, I think, can help us. And that leads us to one of our discussion questions, Jim. How can a robust liberal arts approach make us better at handling the unknown? Because as a teacher, you've always got to be prepared for that. I think as the world continues to change, classrooms continue to evolve. What is the value of a liberal arts education in the education field?
So let's, in that context then, let's define liberal arts, right? Because what does that mean to you? When you ask that question, what are we actually asking in terms of liberal arts?
The broad-based holistic approach, well, you know, we've talked about this before, but stealing it from our university mission and values is one of the places, because we put it very concisely there. There's, you know, book-long explanations on what that is, but no, that a little bit of everything is the two-second elevator pitch that I like to use.
Okay. So I was on the Gen Ed task force this year. And so we've spent a lot of time talking about the liberal arts and really what it is that we're referring to. And so if that's what we're saying it is, it's just a smattering of everything, right? Does that imply jack of all trades and master of none? Is that, it's ultimately, I guess, it allows flexibility, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're saying. And really that's what improv is. I mean, and so in that regard, and I think you would refer to Captain Kirk, right? And we say jack of all trades and master of none as if that's a bad thing, but you're right. That's not a bad thing in that regard. He knows a little bit about everything that's happening on that ship, right? He isn't the guy who knows the specifics about any little thing that's happening. But that's the, I think, in my mind, that's the value of a liberal arts education, because it does give you that little bit of everything. And then you, and then, and that's without, that's within the gen ed sequence, right? And then you go off into your specifics. And that's also why in the University of Jamestown mission statement, it talks about professional studies in addition to the liberal arts, right?
Yep.
Because that's the different piece. But it is interesting to me that, that liberal arts piece, that, that general knowledge, there does have to be an emphasis on those soft skills, which we've been talking about from the very beginning. So there's a question then with that. And maybe this is going off topic a little bit, but is that what all of the gen ed process should be for? Is just,
and I think, yeah. And I think you raise an interesting question. And this is a debate that is happening around the country at every institution of higher education right now, is what constitutes the liberal arts? What is the foundation of what we want to teach? Do we want our schools to devolve into institutions like trade schools, where you come and learn a specific skill set, a specific knowledge base? Well, at the University of Jamestown, for instance, we have dedicated ourselves to this idea that we're going to be a liberal arts institution with very real world practical applications. And so what you were tasked with on that gen ed was figuring out, what does that well-rounded education look like? And so I think that's going to continue to be an evolution of sorts as the world continues to change, because it's impossible, right? It's impossible to know everything. But as you move forward, you do want to know some things. There are some important skills that will help you be a better nurse, that will help you be a better engineer, that will help you be a better teacher, that will help you be a better biologist. And of course, you've got to be specific in your discipline. But I referenced Neil Postman earlier, and I'm using ourselves to death. I found another book by Neil Postman that is not as well known, and it's called The End of Education. And in it, it was written in 1997, and in it, he laments a lot of what we're having to deal with now from a critical standpoint, the idea of multiculturalism, the idea of deconstruction, that there's a lot happening in our world, you know, that words don't mean anything anymore. And it's hard to nail something down if it's jello, right? And so that's what we're dealing with in our world. And he was seeing this coming, but he puts forth this interesting idea when it, as it refers to the liberal arts. We ask educators to do on its face two contradictory things for our students. We ask them to train students to adapt and accept the world as it is. And then on the flip side of that, we ask them to train students to be critical thinkers and to challenge the world as it is. And so if we're looking for a definition of the liberal arts, I think there's better specific definitions, but that's a great working definition in my mind, is that when a student emerges on the other side of graduation here at UJ, have we prepared them to adapt to the world as it is, and conversely, to challenge the world as it is? And meeting some of our graduates, I'm very encouraged. Meeting others of our graduates, I'm discouraged. I had an interaction with a young man that was getting ready to graduate. And of course, there's no names and nothing like that. But in debate, we talk about all kinds of things. And this young man was seriously advocating. It was something that he believed, you know, that we didn't land on the moon, that all of that was fabricated, that all of that was made up. And I was thinking, but you know, he was, there's a difference in questioning those things. I'm not sure we should legitimately question those things, but there's also a difference in being dogmatic that it did not happen, right? And someone that is getting ready to graduate from a liberal arts institution should be a little bit more intellectually humble, right, when it comes to those kinds of ideas. And so adapting to the world as it is, but also a critical thinker in questioning the world. And so I'll let you guys talk about those particular ideas.
Well, but you've got it.
Oh, go ahead, Jim.
Sorry. Oh, you go ahead.
So just to kind of respond to the earlier one, the jack of all trades, I like to put it more as a foundation to apply yourself to anything. That doesn't necessarily mean you will have the knowledge, but you'll know how to gain knowledge. But whatever the situation is, you have a framework for how to deal with it. I always put it in terms of key processes of, you know, whatever the customer comes in with, you're going to handle it. It may be the, wow, that's the most bizarre thing and totally not their fault. Or I don't know why you left your laptop on the stove, but yes, that's a problem sort of scenario. You have a way of dealing with it. And so, you know, just to kind of circle around the beginning of things, really a lot of what we're teaching or hoping that we get out by the time they graduate from here is that framework for how to handle the world as it is, whether it's questioning it or not, as Scott was saying, but there's that framework. And so those improv skills, the thinking on your feet, doesn't necessarily need to be thinking on your feet, but how to handle a new situation is really one of those things we're hoping to convey by the time they graduate from here.
I really enjoyed listening to what Scott had to say about the landing on the moon and the dogmatism versus critical thinking, right? But it really made me think, because when I was teaching, so we're talking 20 years ago, there was a foreign exchange student in my classroom who came from Moldova, and her mind was blown away when we told her that we believed that we did land on the moon, right? She because she was taught the opposite, that the United States had faked that whole thing. Now, that was it. I was very impressed with her, with how she responded to that, and because she was willing to think about our perspective. But I was also encouraged by my students, who nobody called her an idiot, or I mean, they respected her ideas too, some of them did start thinking critically about that as well. And now it's interesting, because a lot of that comes to scale, because we see in history now I do believe we landed on the moon, but when we see history and we look back to how
just for the record,
yeah, just because I don't want it. Well, anyway, but when we look back at history and see the different things that have occurred, that people very firm, that's part of aging too, right? We develop things in our head that we know are true, and we have values that we stick by, and we won't move off of those things regardless of the information that's fed to us. But that is part of aging. That's part of that whole process of wisdom too, because there does have to come a point when we recognize that we can't be swayed by every little thing that comes our way. And so that's important to consider. And I think that's part of our liberal arts education as well, is puts us in a place where we can consider all these pieces and we can think critically about all these things. But in the end, we can draw conclusions and we can have strong set of values, which can put us in a place that can make our world a better place ultimately.
And that is one of the great things about technology these days. I mean, we lament in some cases the students' incessant need to be connected, instant access to information, that sort of stuff. But that just reminded me of a meme I saw, I think it was about a month ago, about, you know, 20 years ago, Aunt so-and-so told us this, and we believed it for 20 years. Now I tell my kid this, and they Google it and tell me I'm wrong. And so it's a double-edged sword, yes, that this instant access to information, but it can also, if we are able to balance that with the critical thinking skills to evaluate the sources of your information, but then reasonably convey them as well. I think that's also seems to be, you know, we'll just lament about that of society in general, the ability to have reasonable discourse and civil disagreements. That's nothing new that happens. The internet just seems to facilitate it that much quicker and louder. So if we can also get that out there, you know, the ability to handle unfamiliar situations, but combine that with this, that would be fantastic.
Jim, we're nearing the end of our hour together. We wanted to give you an opportunity for the last word, anything that you'd like to share with us, anything that you wished that other educators understood better about the education discipline, or perhaps something that's been on your mind that you've been thinking about that you communicate to your students that is very important for their future and for the future of all of us, because education impacts every aspect of our society and lives, whether we're directly involved in it or indirectly. It's a powerful component of who we are.
So you put me in a place of improv where I got to come up with something, some wise words. Yeah. When we think about the world in which we live, when we think about the different things we've talked about, whether it's TikTok or whether it's the internet and all the information we're bombarded with all the time, when we're thinking about how we're going to draw conclusions about the world around us, it's important to recognize that's what our classroom looks like, right? When we have a classroom full of kids, whether they're college students or whether they're first graders, all of these are individuals that have something to add to the conversation and something to add to the wisdom that we have in our minds and something to add to all of the wealth of the knowledge of the world. And in the past, if we were going to go back pre-internet, pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter, and we were going to determine where we got the information which we relied upon, that was from a very central source. And that didn't mean necessarily that it was accurate, right? It wasn't always, and we could look at the landing on the moon, even though I'm convinced we really are taking the word of a very small group of people and applying right. it to what we believe. And one of the beautiful things about the world and one of the beautiful things about education is you get access to people, even if they're five-year-olds that don't have a whole lot of world knowledge yet, that can still contribute to our knowledge that we have. So it's a benefit for all of us as teachers. But
awesome. Well said, Jim. Again, that's been a blast talking with you today. I am sure we will chat again in the future there. And so we will wrap it up for today, but thank you both, Scott and Jim, for your time today. If you enjoyed this episode of the Jimmy Office Hour podcast, please do us a favor and be sure to like, share, subscribe, and rate our program. Let us know what you think and what you might like to hear about in the future, along with sharing the show to a colleague, prospective student, or somebody who might be interested in a liberal arts education. And thank you all for listening. Until next time, this has been the Jimmy Office Hour Podcast.